Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Everyday Anarchism. I'm your host, Graham Culbertson, and we are welcoming back one of my most frequent and most favorite guests, Kim Stanley Robinson, to talk about the Mars Trilogy and Revolution. Stan, thank you so much for coming back on the show.
My pleasure, Graham. It's always a pleasure and good to talk about the Mars Trilogy.
So we were just talking before we started about where we left off our last conversation, which was about the third book of your Three Californias triptych, Pacific Edge, which is there. That's a world in which a revolution has happened. It's a good revolution. Things are pretty good. And you also said in that interview that you were frustrated or felt like you had left that project sort of incomplete because you hadn't actually described how the revolution came about. And that led you to write the Mars Trilogy, which is a revolutionary book through and through. A single book in some ways, is split over into three volumes about multiple revolutions. So I thought we could just start with all of that and see what you had to say from there.
Sure. And I can tell a story that it will please me to tell. My recently deceased good friend, Terry Bisson, he read Pacific Edge after it came out, and he and I had recently met for the first time. So this was, we met in 1988. He read Pacific Edge when it came out in 1990. And he's the one who said to me, "Stan, how did this good world come about?" And I told him that I had written some of the italic sections in Pacific Edge and then dropped them as being somehow insufficient. And I had just left it a blank. And I suggested to him that it had been a not revolution, but reform, that laws had changed, that some class at a law school or some movement had come and managed to take over Congress and managed to pass legislation that got to the world of Pacific Edge. And I must say now I'm even more interested in that kind of notion. But what Terry said to me then was, "It can't happen that way, Stan. There are guns under the table." So I thought about that for a long time. I saw his point. And I wanted to do another utopian novel, which Pacific Edge was, this time set it on Mars with the new society. But this phrase, this perception of Terry's haunted me. And it's the title for, I think it's chapter 6, maybe, of Red Mars, showing that legal reform just by winning votes in democracy is not likely to work if late corporate capitalism has taken over democratic governments, and that you might need something more active. But at the end of Red Mars, and I'll bring this to an end because there's more to be said about all these things, but it occurred to me that you could also do revolution wrong, especially on a newly inhabited planet like Mars. You only had to pop a dome and everybody inside would die. The previous models for how revolutions would work, if you were to apply them, it could be disastrous for the revolutionaries. So at that point, I was grinding away in the plotting of the entire Mars Trilogy. And that was certainly an important realization on my part as I continued to think through the whole thing.
Okay. That was great. That was exactly where I wanted to go. As you were talking, I realized I just sort of assumed that everyone knows what the Mars Trilogy is. And I forgot to introduce what the Mars Trilogy is, which is to say it's a set of novels, this trilogy, in which people, humans, Cold War people, a set of scientists from both the free world and the Soviet world, the first world and the second world, have traveled to colonize Mars. And that's sort of the impetus of it. And it follows, I would say, almost the parallel stories of the scientific discovery and terraforming of Mars and the parallel political scientific discovery of a new world from a governmental and socioeconomic standpoint, hence the series Red Mars, Green Mars, Blue Mars, with the three different stages of terraforming. And there's also three different stages of political development. And while you don't realize it at the beginning of Red Mars, of revolutionary action in each of the novels. So did that establish what the Mars trilogy is? And what do you want to add to that before we move on with this discussion of revolution?
No, that's a good description of it. They're both tracks. So, wilderness and utopia, terraforming and social engineering or political economy applied to a brand new situation where you have also scientists starting it thinking, why couldn't our social life be based on scientific studies of what people need and how they get along and what would be best for the greatest number in some simplistic, naive scientist way. So all those things added to the possibilities for story. And I had an initial cast of characters that included about maybe 8 or 10 point of view characters by the time the trilogy is over that the story keeps coming back to. So each one of them has 3 or 4 novella length chapters through the course of the trilogy. And the first, Red Mars has 8 chapters, Green Mars has 10, Blue Mars has 14. I was trying to suggest a doubling type situation such that if I was to write, Purple Mars, it would have to have 8 more chapters added to 14. And so that it was expanding like a genealogical chart and going crazy. And it was important to stop the novel before it went completely off the rails. So that was my plan starting in, and it determined a lot to have a first 100, a group, an initial scientific station like McMurdo in Antarctica of scientists who were there to set up the base, see what it was like to live there. And then this very rapid follow-up of many more thousands of people from all countries of the world really complicates the project and turns it into a sort of politics as usual, rather than a small group getting to invent the best society like in Moore's Utopia. It's more politics of a lot of different interest groups trying to bash out something that they all like.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And I want to stress how much more complicated it gets than that first group of 100 that I mentioned. I also, I have all these talking points about revolution, but Stan, whenever you and I talk, we talk literature and craft as well, because we're both interested in it. And I was so struck by you saying these novella length things. I feel like I have noticed that large novels have been on the decline at least since the 19th century, which is to say people are writing very large and long novels, but they can often be thought of as a series of novellas, short stories, assemblages, collages. I'm sure there's plenty of counter examples, but I'm thinking of the novelist David Mitchell, who I'm a big fan of, who does almost everything as novellas. Certainly Faulkner's masterpiece, The Sound and the Fury, is actually a series of novellas. It's almost like in this fractured modernist and postmodernist world, the great 19th century single-stranded novel, it's not dead, but it seems to me less practiced than it used to be. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. Certainly, Ministry for the Future is not a novel in the singular focus sense.
I know what you're saying, and it's true, although I would definitely say, Ministry for the Future is a novel, but it's got low protagonicity. There are novels with high protagonicity. Yeah. And so you've got novels where the protagonist takes over almost every scene. Sometimes in first person novels, that becomes really obvious. But I'd say almost everything is still being done and has always been done. Middlemarch was published in 8 volumes in its first publication. Mm-hmm. Now we see it in 1 volume and think of it as a novel, but it switches between Dorothy and the scientist guy. There are at least 3 points of view in Middlemarch that you bounce around amongst. And so I'm thinking of Balzac and his human comedy, these novels that keep bouncing around the same group of characters, sort of. everything has been done since the very beginning. I mean, there's nothing more radical than Tristram Shandy by Laurence Sterne. And so ever since the beginning of the modern novel in England in the 18th century, radical experiments in form are being introduced immediately. So I don't think you can see any trends of that sort. I think the beauty of the novel is that each one has to invent its own form to make its story told in the most effective way in the writer's judgment. And, you know, that judgment can be wrong. You can make formal mistakes, choose the wrong form for the content that you've got, and then struggle ever after. I've done that myself. So what I can say to kind of wrap this up is that in the Mars trilogy, I knew I needed to cover about 200 years of action. Now, that's weird. That does put a pressure on the novel that is unusual, because most novels will stick to one human lifetime as a max length. And a lot of them only cover 2 or 3 years or even a week, etc. Or, you know, Ulysses, this was Joyce's point. You could make a novel about a day and establish the rhythm of a day for all time in literary sense. So the temporal stretches are variable, just like the forms, but doing two or more than 200 years in a novel is a formal challenge that I solved by having novella-length chapters, shifting points of view, and then within each novella, sometimes I would need to cover 30 years, other times 1 week. And I wanted that kind of variability to give the reader some pleasure in changes of tempo. But how you do in a novella, how you describe 20 years of what is daily life, really, rather than always thriller plot, but actually includes how they lived and what they did in ordinary life. This was another challenge. And there's a wonderful book by Gerard Genette. In English, it's called Narrative Discourse. And he talks about the forms of novels in every possible respect. And the hilarious part of it, and I'm sure it's a joke on his part, is that everything that the novel can do, his example of how that works is Proust's novel, Remembrance of Things Past. And what the joke is that Proust's novel does everything a novel can do in formal terms, and he shows it. And it's quite beautiful. And I've loved that book forever. So Genette talks about there's dramatization and summarization. This is a very easy dichotomy that you can understand immediately. But there's another mode that in French has a tense of its own that he calls the pseudo-iterative. So the iterative is the same thing happens every day. It's like Groundhog Day. But even in Groundhog Day, it teaches you that it isn't the same day every day because Bill Murray does something different every day within the pattern of that day. And so what Genette calls the pseudo-iterative is that it says we, in those days, we used to do X, Y, and Z, but then it gets so particular that you can't imagine that that happened more than once, but it's variations on a theme, and the theme gets exposed by going into detail about one of the variations. So it's not quite dramatization or summarization. It's a variation on a theme, and you get the theme as well as the variation. The particularity of a given event is shown to be representative of a year of your life or 10 years of your life, if you're one of these characters on Mars. Well, this was an immensely powerful springboard for me to a kind of writing that I had never done before. Essentially, the Mars trilogy has a modality of writing that I had never even tried. I had never conceptualized it, nor had I had the need for it in my earlier novels. So when I latched onto that and I began to practice it by simply writing scenes with that thought in mind, then something began to go on in the Mars trilogy that was way beyond anything that I had managed previously. I mean, there's several novels that come before the Mars trilogy of my own that I like, but there's nothing that is as expansive and powerful as the Mars trilogy. So as I was writing it, I began to feel like, okay, I've stumbled into a completely new world, and it's like lightning from the fingertips, you know, as I'm typing and I don't know what's going to come out of it. remarkable things were coming out of it. And it was fun. You know, it was a pleasure.
So, first of all, I haven't read that book. I need to read it. That's fascinating. Secondly, it seems to me, and I could put my structuralist hat on and come up with a term. It seems to me that the Three Californias triptych is also pseudo iterative, but almost from the exact opposite way. Does that make sense? This, instead of the same thing happening, but different over and over again, it's a totally different thing happening in each of those three books, but it's the same and the same place and at least one of the same characters. Yeah. It's a reversal of, they're both pseudo iterative, or we could call one pseudo iterative and the other anti pseudo iterative or something like that. I don't know if that was conscious or maybe I'm just, you know, thrashing in the dark, but I'm struck by this repetition in both these parallel. I'm seeing these series in parallel now.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. I'm thinking about it as you were saying it, because it hadn't occurred to me, but they are indeed reversals of the method, in that I was explicitly in the Three Californias taking similar cast of characters, similar landscapes, and three radically different histories that they lived in. So you got, especially with Tom, the same guy genetically, he lives three different lives because he's in three different histories. So yes, and then I guess the point of the pseudo-iterative is a little more granular, or you get to the level of what were things like for the first 100, for their second 10 years on Mars, and you've got 30 pages to describe it. Well, at that point, you begin to struggle with compression and with what's the representative moment that gives people the feeling of that 10 years without going into the details of every day of those 10 years. Then you really have to go into a kind of a lyric or poetical, like Proust, we used to do this, and then he goes into immense detail. So you realize they didn't do that more than once because it's too singular. And that mode is beautiful. I fell in love with it. I repeated it, the mode. I was using a similar pseudo-iterative mode for the years of Rice and Salt, which covers even more years, 700 years rather than 200. But I could do the same thing with novellas that gave a quality of ordinary life, or la vie quotidienne, which, you know, one of the things that I readers of my work often comment on is, you know, where's the plot or why is this so slow? But I think people read novels not just for plot, which is things going wrong, but for a kind of anthropology. What was it like to live, you know, in France in the 1820s? Or what was it like to live on the moons of Jupiter in the year 3000? You have an urge to learn culture, daily life. There's a series of books that I quite love called Daily Life in Inca Peru, or Daily Life in Medieval Rome, that tries to give you what the meals were like, what people's habits were like, how they structured their days, et cetera. Anthropology. Well, people read novels for plot for sure, but also for anthropology. And this, since I was making it up, what would the first human civilization on Mars look like? I had to, it felt important to me to convey daily life for these people, and not just the plot of things going wrong, which is going to happen anyway, but you need it, but you also wanted a way to convey daily life. And that's what the pseudo iterative gave to me.
Yeah, that's fantastic. This, you know, this does bring me, I'm finally going to bring it around to one of the questions that I was planning on asking you. I actually have 20 more things to say that are not in the questions I wanted to ask you, but I want to get to Revolution. So, I'm a big fan of this history podcaster named Mike Duncan, and I was thinking of his introduction to the French Revolution when I was thinking about this series, because he says something like, you know, the Marxists are right about the French Revolution in the grand sweep of things. You know, there was people who had less power and less money, and they rebelled against the people who had more and chopped their heads off, et cetera. And then a more distributed, more bourgeois government was created. So far, so good. You get high up enough and the French Revolution is a Marxist revolution. Then you get down in the weeds and you find the peasants killing the proletariat in the name of the king. And all of a sudden, the Marxists don't seem to be right at all because it's so granular. The Marxists are right in one day and wrong the next because history is lived in these moments and by these individuals. And I was thinking, oh, you go right ahead if you want to jump in at this point.
No, go on.
Okay, sorry. I was thinking, you know, when I think of this trilogy and these three books and the three revolutions in them, I almost didn't realize when each revolution comes that the revolution has come. I was in the midst of it with these characters, and sometimes they're self-consciously revolutionizing, but sometimes they're just trying to survive or save their friends or stop someone from doing something bad. And the revolution, which would look orderly from a God's eye view, is chaotic and sometimes even quotidian from the point of view of these characters. And that felt like the real teeming, as you say, anthropological, what it would be like on the ground in one of these revolutionary moments, even though the people and the moments are fictional. I thought you conveyed that, and I guess I'm curious if that sounds right to you and if you were aiming for that.
Yes, that does sound right, and I was aiming for it with some, and I can add to that in terms of other things I was aiming for. And I just want to say in passing that you can't say the Marxists, because each Marxian historian has a different take on these things. And I myself am what you might call a Jamesonian Marxist. And one thing Jameson teaches is to pay close attention to each theorist and each situation that they're describing. And Marx himself is not a uniform point of view over the course of his life and career. So, and Marxian theory does very well at describing the kind of counter-revolutions in the West where there were people fighting hard for the royalist side, but that's all accountable for in a larger view of what was going on there. And so the French Revolution is, of course, a great test case, and you have Burke and you have Carlyle's great description of it. These are kind of descriptions from the point of view of royalist people who approve monarchy and what went wrong there in France, etc. So it's a great test case for people trying to explain how history works. But what I'm going to add to that is history is contingent. There are no patterns that hold. You can maybe explain why something happened, but it will not help you to explain the next thing that happened another generation on, because by then too much has changed, especially the technological base and what's going on. So when I was thinking about these things in the Mars trilogy, reading as much as I could and pondering it, because I got to make one up, right, and try to make it reflect what might happen in a way that the readers both enjoyed it for itself and found it illuminating for our real history here on Earth so far. If you take an earlier revolution as your model, and the classic example of this in science fiction is Robert Heinlein pretending that in A Moon is a Harsh Mistress, that you could do the American Revolution from the surface of the moon. And this is very lame. Heinlein is a lame, poverty stricken imagination when it comes to history itself. A bad theorist and a bad practitioner because of that. And I thought, this is such a lie. What I have to show is that if people are seduced into that idea on Mars, at the end of Red Mars, there are some people saying, well, let's just fight to free ourselves like in the American Revolution from the power of Earth. And boom, they're smashed. And my characters are then just trying to save their friends, as you said. So the revolution is happening slightly offstage from our point of view people, because they're just trying to get out of it alive because it's gone so badly wrong, because there are people who were thinking, we'll just do it like the American Revolution. So the Green Mars, they recollect themselves. They live a lot of time passes in Green Mars, perhaps more than in Red. I probably parsed it at the time, but I don't remember the time scales. By the time they get to Green Mars, they've had to re-theorize what would it take to free oneself from the overwhelming power of Earth when you're on a little space base that essentially can be cracked like an egg. Well, it needs to be more robust, less crackable, and you kind of need something to happen to the overwhelming power of Earth. So it's when the Western Arctic ice sheet comes off, sea level goes up by something like 10 meters in 6 months. This is a rather astonishing event on Earth. It wrecks everything on Earth, or at least disrupts everything on Earth. And then the Martian revolutionaries can say, now's our time. Earth's so distracted, they can't cope with us. And we have a better way of taking over, more comprehensive, more subtle, more difficult to forestall and beat back down. So the revolution at the end of Green Mars kind of works. But of course, there's always unfinished business. And then to really make it a cultural revolution as well as a political revolution, you have all the action of Blue Mars. And then at the end of Blue Mars, is it a revolution or is it some kind of strange exfoliation of the new culture emerging out of the shell of the old, so that it isn't really a violent revolution at the end of Blue Mars, but more a kind of everything coming into play at once and changing. So this is how I was theorizing it: a failed revolution, a successful revolution, and then some kind of a cultural evolution that appears all at once and kind of changes Earth itself. So Mars culture becomes a kind of vanguard culture to a more utopian state for human beings. And it's obviously back changing the dominant Earth culture, at least in some ways.
I just want to say, we talked about, we talked about California as a vanguard in that way, in the actual world that we live in. That utopian California has in some ways, influenced the rest of the United States in the 20th century. That was in our conversation about High Sierra.
Well, I'm still living the dream. I'm very very proud of California. Of course, it's a struggle, and of course, California is embedded in global capitalist culture. It doesn't have independence to choose its own way because it's under the heavy hand of capital. But that said, as the fifth biggest economy on Earth, it has some autonomy, and although it's part of the United States, it has some autonomy there too, and it's remarkable to watch how it's trying to cope with all the problems that we're faced with right now.
Okay, I want to leave that there for now, because I want to confront the A word. We've barely talked about anarchism yet together. I mean, a few times, but I've developed my theory of anarchism in the novels of Kim Stanley Robinson, and you can tell me what you think of it. And I guess this goes back to the idea of things wouldn't happen simply through laws and judgments. And by the way, listeners, very early spring here in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and the birds are going crazy. I hope you find this sound pleasant rather than distracting.
I like it.
Yeah. Yeah, good. I'm glad to hear that. So my theory goes something like this, which is whatever we're looking at, the Mars trilogy, certainly, I'm thinking of the book Antarctica, and I'm sure I've scribbled down some other ideas, some other examples from your novels, which of course I'm forgetting now that I'm talking to you, is that the anarchists are... The other one I'm thinking of course, is Ministry for the Future. The anarchists are good. The anarchists are out there fighting the good fight. The anarchists are on the right side. We all love the anarchists up until a certain point in time when it comes time to reconstitute the new society. And at that point, the anarchists become I don't think they're ever cast out into the cold or executed or anything like that in any of these novels, but they sort of cease to be the main event as cooler and more diplomatic and more systems-minded people end up developing the new world that's going to be. Now, I think besides Desmond in the Mars trilogy, all the people that I'm calling anarchists don't even necessarily call themselves anarchists, but the people who practice direct action, sabotage, possibly even terrorism, they're not the villains in these movements, these fictional and yet historical movements that you are creating, but neither are they the final iteration of the revolutionary moment, but they are in some ways, in a good way, handmaidens usually. So that's my theory of anarchism in the novels of Kim Stanley Robinson. I must admit, I'm very curious to hear what you think.
Well, thank you for that, Graham. It's super interesting for me. And I'm thinking as you talk, I'm writing down notes. I'm trying to ponder. I have definitely thought about this before. And I'm also trying simply to remember because it's important. So one time I was asked to write a introduction to a book of anarchist science fiction stories, and I did. And what I concluded there that I can hold on to that I remember strongly from that is there's a fundamental and abiding confusion about what anarchism is. So, and it goes back to the word itself. Does it mean no laws, or does it mean no rulers? And for me, as a political citizen like everybody else, it better mean no rulers. And at that point, God bless it. It's essentially the compass north. It's the ultimate goal of human history to get to the point where there are no rulers and everybody has an equal share of power and wealth. The horizontalization of power and wealth, complete horizontalization, where everybody's got equal, the Gini figure would be zero, et cetera. I believe in that. I believe also that it's a horizon that we're not at yet, and it's going to be a long haul to get there, but it's a worthy goal, and it's not impossible either, because there are some interim steps. If you were to say, no, what I mean is that no laws, this is sort of a libertarian anarchism, that there's no laws whatsoever, people just get together and agree on what to do and do what needs doing and blah, blah, blah. I flatly disbelieve it, especially with 8 billion people, but actually in any crowd bigger than about 100 people, I flatly disbelieve it. I believe in the rule of law, that people together make up some laws about how they're going to operate with each other. They agree to abide by the laws, and that way you avoid anarchy, which is, of course, the common sense of lawlessness, where things are simply chaotic because, in fact, people disagree. And if you don't have adjudication and even courts and law, then the disagreements simply lead to disorder and murder in the end. And might makes right. So I am flatly opposed to that. So this, having expressed it like this, which is kind of almost a first for me, although maybe I wrote it this way, I'm confronted with a somewhat of a dilemma based on the term itself being having two possible interpretations. I'm completely happy with the end of rulers. I'm completely in disbelief of the idea of the end of laws. So, that said, anarchism plays a small part in any of my novels. It's not that violent resistance is necessarily anarchic. It could be targeted. It could be planned. It could be highly disciplined. It could be a ruler telling his poor people, you go out and strap bombs on yourself and blow yourself up, and I'll be back here and I'll strategize the next move. So there can be within violent resistance some outrageously selfish and ruler and ruled master-slave relations. We see this today. So you can't say that terrorists are always anarchists. Mm-hmm. In fact, oftentimes they are horrific fascists who are trying to terrify their political opposition because they could never win in a free election because nobody wants them. And so then they decide that they're going to take matters into their own hands and murder people in order to scare other people. And even use their own people as suicide bombers. So all that sucks so badly that you get into a tangle of definitions and you begin to have to say, look, if we're going to talk about any of this at all, let's get to specific examples. Let's not talk political theory because it's too vague and airy. And when it's applied to real situations, it often backfires or it goes sideways, turns into something that nobody expected in the first place. Sometimes it can be quite good. Examples of that are just pretty damn frequent, of things going well despite not conforming to anybody's political plans. So I was thinking all this stuff in the Mars trilogy. And for sure, Desmond, what he has, though, you got to remember syndicalism. And you got to remember the cooperative movements and worker employee power, workers' power, workers' councils. Every once in a while, like in Germany, in West Germany, or in Yugoslavia, the employees of a company will get 50% of the shareholder votes. It isn't just shareholders. It's the employees that help to run a company. In politics, you have direct democracy type movements and all these kind of things going on, and syndicalism. I actually forget what the definition of syndicalism was, but I think it was the idea that you could have some power that shared at the smaller level and then not have any larger levels. And then what you have is kind of a lack of rulers, and cooperatives are a matter of business still running, money still existing, but people having power over their own life as workers. And so these kind of political questions were what began to throw themselves in my way writing up the Mars book, where I wasn't just describing revolutions, but what's the society that comes next that's better than late stage capitalism? Well, I had to scour the mainstream conventional economists are nearly useless when it comes to giving you a new economic system. They don't do speculative economics. They don't do projective economics. They're chicken. They just describe what is and say, oh, this is natural when it isn't natural. So economics was nearly useless, but there were people like Murray Bookchin, Herman Daly, Hazel Henderson, Joan Robinson. There were indeed leftist economists saying that from where we are now, we ought to do these things. Oh, and Hahnel, Albert and Hahnel with their participatory economics. This was a small thing from the 90s. I don't know that it ever got much attention or traction, but it gave me a lot of help trying to figure out the Martian society. So these were the kind of issues that I was dealing with as I tried to make up a story, a history of Mars over 200 years that eventually bashed its way to some kind of post-capitalism. And it had to do with Coyote thinking there's the gift economy there. And this is important too. There were pre-capitalisms where you did what needed doing and you gave to other people. And of course that can turn into potlatching and be a power system of its own. But he was a highly, I used him. He was a character who knew what he was doing. And a lot of the characters in the Mars trilogy are not politically savvy, but Coyote, Desmond Hawkins, was. And so he was able to explain to some of the other characters what they were up to and what he was trying to do as he tried to nudge Martian history in directions he thought were better. And he's a minor but important nudge factor in Martian history.
Yeah, I mean, the short answer is I think that all makes sense. To take the two parts of your response just briefly, I don't think I have much to say. First, I think this idea makes sense in terms of the lack of rulers versus the lack of rules. And there's certainly a split, I don't want to go into this, between people who think that anarchy or anarchism or whatever basically means no large scale assemblages of anything versus people who think anarchism can have all sorts of large scale assemblages if they are worker directed co-ops, democratic, that sort of thing. I'm certainly in the second group. So I have a broader sense of what anarchism is, which also leads plenty of people describe me as not an anarchist, which is, again, gets into this question of terminology. I don't find it that useful. I do find the exactly what you're talking about, the nudges that you're talking about from someone like Desmond, really useful and interesting in the novel. And there's you know, we're heading towards the end of our conversation. There's one specific moment that really stands out to me. I think it's, I've got the page number, but I don't need to rifle through my book. It's in Blue Mars, in which they are making up the political system of their revolution. And Desmond says, we did it. We killed the center. So we're actually done with the revolution. Everyone is just doing what they need to do right now. And we don't need to have a new governmental system that will inevitably become a center and power corrupts. And I'm blanking on his name right now. The guy who's at the representative practice, Art, maybe? Art says, kind of jokingly, like, "Oh no, that's what we're doing, Desmond. We're going to put it back together so that everyone just is in charge locally and working together, and it's exactly what you want it to be." And this pisses Coyote off because he's like, "No, like once you start assembling these co-ops across this larger thing, you've given up the dream that I wanted." But I'm willing to agree with Art, and it sounds like also you, that the aim of anarchism can be achieved in these, you know, this commune of communes, or however you want to put it. But I also hear Desmond's voice echoing in the back of my mind: once you start building this stuff, it'll get out of your control. And then the last quick historical note I want to make is this figure I haven't covered on the podcast yet, the absolutely brilliant novelist Victor Serge, who is an anarchist. And when the Bolsheviks take over, he throws his lot in with them, and he says something along the lines of, "Yeah, I don't agree with them, but someone has got to put this back together. We can't just leave, like, you know," Coyote says, "just leave it how it is, and everybody will put it back together in this grassroots way." And Victor Serge says, "We can't do that. That's going to be a disaster. I'm an anarchist, but we can't just let it sort of knit back together. We got to figure this out, and we got to feed these people." And I both understand Victor Serge's impulse, and then also he ends up, you know, fleeing from Stalin very shortly after that. So I see the reason not to join up with the Bolsheviks. And I'm struck by how well you captured that moment in this book.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I'm trying to think both the historical examples that you're bringing up and also what I did in the Mars trilogy. And
if that's too much, just pick one. I'm sorry, I threw a ton at you.
The two are dialectical, and I'll focus on the Mars trilogy, because that, having considered the historical examples of the backlash to revolution, you got the French Revolution, then you have Napoleon, you have the Russian Revolution, then you have Stalin. The taking over by, if it's a violent revolution, then the most successfully violent portion of the revolutionaries then can take over and become a kind of a leadership by thuggery and destroy all of the good, or let's say a lot of the good, or some of the good that happened in the revolutionary fervor itself. On Mars, and I'm thinking of Mars now as a kind of a thought experiment to teach us what we need to do on Earth. So always the Mars trilogy was a kind of a funhouse mirror to show where we were on Earth right now. And it still works pretty well that way, because we are still in late capitalism and trying to figure out the way forward, which, because of climate change, because of the COVID pandemic, because of world history and the end of the Cold War, the rise of technologies, we're in a peculiar moment where the nation state system and global capitalism as a combined political economy is not adequate to the problems we're facing. Not only that, but it's the system that created a lot of those problems because of lack of attention to the biosphere. And on Mars, you had to pay attention to the biosphere because you were making it up as you go. And what's interesting is now we are kind of making up Earth's biosphere. We have terraforming powers here on Earth. So then the way that you run politics to deal with your life support system becomes of crucial interest, because we're wrecking our life support system in the political economy that we're in right now. And we have to use it to leverage ourselves into a different political economy that is better attuned to the realities of the biosphere and our bodies. Okay. And it's become almost emergency level, like a crisis. We got to do it fast. And we're not good at fast, not in politics. So in the Mars trilogy, I had the luxury, because they were making their world, of taking 200 years. I mean, Blue Mars is incredibly expansive. By the time I got to Blue Mars, I was kind of flying, like I'd escaped orbit or gravity. In a narrative sense, the thing is proliferating, and side stories are happening, and grandchildren's stories are happening, etc. But the main political line of the story continues. Oh, we got a trash truck coming by here. So if you hear loud noises that are not birds, it's the recycling truck. So on the one hand, we're talking about it as if it were historical problems to be solved. For me, they were plot problems to be solved in a novel. How do I finish a novel in a way that is satisfactory as well as suggestive politically, but making also a good story with my characters coming to good endings? Well, it's a lot of overdetermining circumstances. And all I can say is that back in the early 90s, when I was writing this stuff, there was a sense of political opportunity, of Martian opportunity, in terms of we didn't understand the planet was as poisonous as it is, as we understand it to be now, that I could actually play these games and come out of it successfully, I will say. I love the Mars trilogy. It changed my life. It was the first time I felt like I had done something that I didn't understand how I did it. And so there was a sense of deep surprise. I still have that. I look at the Mars trilogy, where did that come from? I had very little to do with it. On the other hand, I did a lot of grinding work and conceptual work, but also just sentence work. And it seems like it worked out. So a combination of historical possibility, the political moment of the early 90s, my own evolution as a writer in terms of experiences and boldness, you might say, it all came together. And so that was transformative for me. And now I feel quite alienated from the Mars trilogy. When I look at it, it's somebody else who did it. I don't quite remember doing it. I can talk about it with you. I'm surprised. When we talk about it, a lot of it comes back. But unless I'm in a specific and focused and coherent conversation like ours, mostly I look at this book and go, wow, where'd that come from? And I feel quite a deep alienation from it.
That seems like kind of a strange moment to end on, but also I don't want to take up your time any more than this. So I guess I'll say this. First of all, that's a fascinating insight and does accord. I mean, I've never written anything like the Mars trilogy, but it does seem that when I am writing something, whether it's creating a syllabus or writing an essay or something, it does seem often that I work very, very, very hard, grind very hard. And then somehow the writing emerges from that. And yet I can grind willfully, but I can't write willfully, if that makes sense. It has something to do with the unconscious process of language. I don't know. That's maybe neither here nor there. So no. I guess I just need to say, is there anything else before we go you want to say?
Well, that sounds right to me. You grind at the conscious level. You're just grinding as hard as you can. Different things are happening at subconscious and unconscious levels that you have to trust. And if they come through for you, which doesn't always happen, but if you set it up right and they come through for you, then the process, sometimes I put it like this, I feel like the curator of the of a close relative who I don't know very well. So like some crazy uncle is mailing me stuff, and then I have to present it to the world. But that's fine. There's something beautiful about that feeling. And I'm not complaining about it. I'm saying it's a beautiful feeling to have this sense that it's not up to me. to a certain extent, it's coming from somewhere else. And the last thing I guess I would like to add is about 3 or 4 or 5 years later, after the Mars trilogy was done, and I believe in endings. Like, I'll never write Purple Mars or the next Mars thing. My British editor convinced me that there were some precursor stories and some side stories that I had cut out of the text. She said, couldn't you do a companion volume that would just be a miscellany of dribs and drabs and side stories, and then incorporate the Roger and Eileen plot, which is a sort of an alternative history of Mars that it doesn't quite match with the trilogy, and make a companion volume. And I thought, I had an urge to revisit characters like Sax or Coyote and Maya. I had an urge to revisit the characters because it was like Calvin and Hobbes. You know how Hobbes is totally alive for Calvin, but there's a panel every 20 or 30 panels, you get to see Calvin from the outside, and Hobbes is just a stuffed doll sitting there on the table. And Calvin is enthusiastically talking about his conversations with Hobbes, and all the adults are looking at him and thinking that the stuffed little tiger doll is not as interesting as Calvin seems to think it is. Well, I finished the Mars trilogy, and all those characters went silent on me. They froze in place. The book's over. They're not speaking to me anymore. Well, for about 5 or 6 years, these were speaking people in my life, like Hobbes with Calvin. I mean, it's internal. It's a little crazy, but it's a real feeling. And so I did the Martians thinking, well, maybe I can give them a chance and see if they'll speak to me again. And quite a few times they did, so that I could create alternative histories to Mars. Like, it was important that they went to Mars, because otherwise the lives of Michelle and Maya would be completely wrecked if they had stayed on Earth, if there was no Mars expedition. So there's that strand, there's the Roger and Eileen strand, but then there's also little prose poems of Sax just reflecting on his people, Coyote reflecting on his people, Jackie reflecting on bringing up Zoe as a child, which there was no opportunity for that in the Mars trilogy, these different points of view, and even some poems set on Mars, etc. So I still quite love the Martians as, and this is more of a personal feeling than a literary feeling. In literary terms, it's utterly redundant and unnecessary. You don't need it to have a good experience with the Mars trilogy. It's a tack on. It's like, if you want more and you get more, it won't be more plot. It will be these strange prose poems and sidebars. But for me, it was important because 5 years later, I got to kind of check back in and see whether the characters really were alive for me or not. And they mostly were. And, I'm really fond of several of the pieces in The Martians, which I think if there are people who have read the Mars trilogy, very often they don't even know about the Martians, or they don't bother to check in with it. But if they've been fond of the characters in the Mars trilogy, then I think they will enjoy, if they read The Martians when they can still remember the Mars trilogy, which is another question, I think they would really enjoy it. I had some quite beautiful experiences for my own writing life of just getting out of the way myself personally and letting these characters speak and seeing what they said. It was very startling and a kind of a beautiful experience. And so I guess that's what I'd leave you with, rather than the sense of alienation. I mean, that existed, but what I'm saying here is that there was a moment about 5 years after I finished the trilogy where I tapped back into it. And it worked. I don't think it would work now. Honestly, I really don't. They're too far gone. And too much has happened since. But for a while there, I had this kind of magical return to the space of the Mars trilogy. And it was a lot of fun.
All right. I should say I'm reading The Martians right now. I was hoping to have it done before this interview, but I didn't make it. And when I started The Martians, it was so the same and also different that I was alienated from it at first. And I read the first story, which was so jarring. I had to put it down for a week or two. And now I'm back into it. And I do recommend it for anyone who has read the Mars trilogy, although it does seem like you need to have read it recently.
I think so. Actually, that first story in The Martians, I intended it to be a punch on the nose.
I did not. It punched me. I did not appreciate it.
Well, it's okay. I mean, in literary terms, every once in a while, I like a punch on the nose from writers I love if they shock me. But for Michelle to cancel the whole mission and the whole trilogy get erased, that is a you shocking. Got me. That's a shocking move. But he pays for it. Anyway, I would say for John that I'm fond of that as a companion volume, but it's unnecessary. That's for damn sure.
All right. Stan, this is such a pleasure as always. Thank you so much for coming to talk the Mars Trilogy with me.
Oh, my pleasure, Graham.